Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 58, right at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 664. All right, so we're moving forward very definitively now with the story. Recall how the previous paper ended. They were stepping us quite rapidly, relative to the previous ages, through blocks of 50 million years. And so we went from 800 million years ago to, you can see, we're going to be starting at 600 million years ago here. As we get into section one of this paper, we step through that quite quickly. We're basically just pointing out that you had a lot of physical evolution that needed to occur. And so now they're ready to bring in the actors in our play here again and give us a little bit more on what's involved in synchronizing life up to the physical evolutionary process. I think we don't really need to say much more than that. We'll just get started here, and you'll see we have a something kind of a little bit different that's coming up in the beginning part of this paper. A little to the side, they're going to give us. Let's pick up a little bit more of the sequential story here.
Paper 58, Life Establishment on Urantia. In all Satania, there are only 61 worlds similar to Urantia, life modification planets. The majority of inhabited worlds are peopled in accordance with established techniques. On such spheres, the life carriers are afforded little leeway in their plans for life implantation. But about one world in 10 is designated as a decimal planet and assigned to the special registry of the life carriers. And on such planets, we are permitted to undertake certain life experiments in an effort to modify or possibly improve the standard universe type of living beings.
Okay, so you see what they're reminding us of again. That's always first and foremost when you think about synchronizing life to the physical evolutionary process on our planet, is where that, roughly every 10 world exception to the rule kind of a planet. And, as they start out there in that second sentence when they said that the majority of inhabited worlds are peopled in accordance with established techniques. You don't want to overplay that, as they remind you when you get to the end of the paragraph. Those established techniques, there's foundational aspects that are, definitely established and not variable, because they have to do with the specificity of this local universe and this local system. But the fullness of what is established gets reestablished, roughly every 10 worlds, because they're running a test. When they say there at the end, our effort to modify or possibly improve the standard universe, right? If the experiment, has positive results, definitely what's the ongoing established techniques subsequent to that will be redefined, taking into account the results of the experiment. And remember also fundamentally what's the experiment about. It's not, randomly, what might we try? They're doing an experiment. They're testing not their unfettered creativity. Right? They are trying to figure out where the supreme is. Enough time has rolled by that merely after 10 worlds, they need to do a test again. Yeah, so obviously they're looking for very subtle, minute changes in that ubiquitous presence of the overarching fact of evolution and how that's going to impact the way things play out. And it's not just an issue of, you know, looking along the physical evolutionary line or looking along the biologic evolutionary line, you know, how that line sort of in and of itself or any other line might be different now than it used to be way back when. But the interplay between all those lines, as we've stressed, you have just one evolutionary process with many phases within it. And so, as I was just stressing, this synchronizing the biologic evolutionary process up with the physical evolutionary process, they're looking for how that's going to be different, how those synchronize now than they used to. Besides, yes, just in and of itself, there may be some differences in any given line as well. The mind evolution, the spirit evolution, whatever, all the different phases of the whole evolutionary process. So they got to take into account all kinds of things that we can't even remotely understand right now. It would be it's going to be all kinds of people on hand, assessing the results of all this, looking for all sorts of subtle variations. And so you can imagine that there's quite an additional entourage of people involved with a decimal world, just to keep up with all the increased level of scrutiny of what's going on. Okay, so that's again basically what we have in play, they don't, as I was stressing before, these modifications are not going to be in any way extreme, where something could go radically, fundamentally astray, and the whole thing just wouldn't work. But there could be little issues of, there were some positives there, but there was this negative side effect is not what we were hoping for. So I guess we really can't go with it that way. There are going to be some things like that. And so, the trials and tribulations on that world might be a little more, okay. But that's, all of us have to, in one way or another, we have to be brave and face the facts that we live in an evolutionary domain, and no one is trying to hurt us just for the sake of pain and suffering. There's always pain and suffering. It just might have a different twist on some worlds, than the norm. And that's the way it is. Yeah.
So it says we're the 61 worlds. So if you add us, that means there are 62 worlds left.
No. Remember that we're the 60th. They pointed that out before. Okay. We're the 60th, but there's been another one since us.
But it says there are only 61 worlds similar to your answer.
Right. The 59 before us and the one after us.
Well, that would be 60 then. Similar.
They're including us, right?
No. Do you think they are?
Yeah, because remember, they've already told you that we're the 60th. They told you that. And we can all, count from 606 to 619.
But the way it's said, there are only 61 well, similar to your rancho. I guess I don't say other world.
Again, see, I mean, remember how, you know, it's up to the reader to go beyond the immediate sentence.
I got that, but that could mean, you know, maybe just, there's 62 in that case.
It could, but you can rule that out. See, that's what I'm trying to get at. There's many ways you can interpret any sentence.
Well, you can rule it out because of what you said a second ago.
Right. You rule it out by looking at the other things in the book, you know, where you know how many there's been since us. So you know there's been one since us, and you know we're the 60th. Those are the other two data points you have. So you know the 61 includes us. So and it's like, well, that wasn't the first way I would think of it interpreting that sentence.
No.
See, that's just what, you know.
I didn't see the 60th part. But there's coming down.
We touched on that before. Right. It's worth just, you know, focusing on that for a second. There's a number of places in the book where if you just take what's in front of you, just in that paragraph or that section, it will lead you astray in and of itself. And readers have done that many times over the decades. And there's a lot of really established false interpretations because they haven't looked at all of the other passages that are related to that, included them. You have to come up with interpretation that takes into account all passages, all relevant passages, not just one.
I could read this, that in all Satania there are only 61 life modification planets. Mm-hmm. And world similar to your ancestors. So, I mean, in other words, what you're saying is when you first read it, if you don't remember the others, you're saying, it seems like it's 61 more.
Yeah.
But then you're saying,
okay. Right, see? Right. They're just, you know, instead of describing it, they're describing it by pointing to us, you know. Right, see? So you see how, I see, and you can see you can interpret it that way. So you have to be on your toes. There's many, many places in the book like that where, you know, if you, it all seems airtight. You got this whole section. It's like, okay, I think I understand what's going on here. But you haven't taken into account the section that's three papers, you know, before or after that one that adds another little nugget and changes the proper interpretation of that section.
So if you carry this out a little further and you know, trying to figure out, well, how many other worlds possibly could have gone into rebellion, you know, then you look at and you say this is one every 10, and you do, what is it, 200 worlds every couple of billion years or something like that. Isn't that what you kind of figured out?
You know how many worlds went into rebellion, and you also know that none of the ones that became inhabited since us joined the rebellion.
Right,
you
know? Okay.
So you've got it pinned down. You know, there's the 37 worlds, right, including us.
But how many of them would be experimental planets is a question I was trying to
think. Yeah.
That's sort of a double whammy for us, being experimental and in rebellion.
Right, right. You know, it's a little, you know, I mean, obviously you'd be speculating, trying to figure out whether or not it's an Achilles heel. You know, maybe, you know, it will make us feel better to say, well, you know, we can't really help it. We're a decimal planet. And I mean,
we're getting full experience. We're starting out at the real bottom.
But what happens if you get to, you get up on the mansion worlds and you discover, oh, we were the only decimal world to join the rebellion? Dang it. I thought that was a great excuse. right. So,
30 out of 37.
Couldn't really grasp that. Wouldn't have been that many in that
37. Anyway.
It couldn't have been, right?
Okay, so, yeah, so, but anyway, just, you know, on that point, we'll see another great example of this coming up in section 2. There are many, many unfortunate ways that you can approach interpreting the words that are in front of you. And, all but one of those are false. You got to figure out which one is true. It's very likely that the first six interpretations you come up with are all false. including the one that really strikes your fancy.
I don't want to turn people off from starting to read the book from beginning to end.
No.
Just because they got to figure everything out in the meantime.
The whole point is read, but what's one of the favorable conditions that I'm trying to stress you keep in mind? Humble.
Okay. Yeah, right.
Right? Yes, read. You know, read with great delight, but read with humility. Right?
It kind of
make sure you stay humble.
Talks to you.
Yeah. Just make sure you know up front. It's trying to challenge me. The proper interpretation is not what I'm gonna immediately suspect, right? Because I have a whole bunch of elements of my worldview that I don't recognize I have. They're in a completely unconscious part of my mind. I have no idea that all of my thoughts are predicated on those initial assumptions. It's never even occurred to me. So you just have to, things that seem definitive. It's like, well, this has to be the correct interpretation. Are you sure? Have you followed your line of reasoning all the way back to the unconscious initial assumptions? And if you assume that your entire mindful self is a conscious space, that's a very poor assumption. Because very little of it is conscious space. Okay? It's extremely unlikely that your initial assumptions are part of the conscious part of your mindful self. Right? So you need to work on reflective thinking, and trying to penetrate to those uncharted areas of consciousness and become aware of, oh, this is my initial assumption. Where did I get that from? You got it from handed down to you from a philosopher 600 years ago is where you got it from, and you never even read a philosophy text. It's like, well, it's in the air you breathe, so to speak. It's this stuff all seeps into our framework. Okay, so let's get to this first chunk here.
One, physical life prerequisites. 600 million years ago, the commission of life carriers sent out from Jerusalem arrived on Urantia and began the study of physical conditions preparatory to launching life on world number 606 of the Satania system. This was to be our 606th experience, with the initiation of Nebadon life patterns in Satania and our 60th opportunity to make changes and institute modifications in the basic and standard life designs of the local universe.
Okay, they reminded you of the 60th right there.
Right between the eyes.
Okay, so it seems innocuous enough, but okay, this is a big thing. Remember, we noticed something very cool happened the last time the life carriers showed up, right? They're back again. Okay, remember, even when they haven't been modified, they're an active phenomenon. Is there anything, if you take 600 million times 4, right, and get 2.4 billion years ago for a radiometric date, is there something that you notice, that we've discovered geologically? Yes, there is. You notice that starting right around this time when they came back, we begin to have very definitive evidence that there is considerable oxygen in our atmosphere. Right? So they've recognized that we're getting close here, to launching it forward. As they're describing there, about how they're getting ready to make it happen here. So they've instructed all the other, the power beings that are involved and whatnot, right, to kind of move into the final stages here of getting the planet terraformed, getting the planet ready for the implantation of life. And we definitely see that. You start to see lots of iron oxide, rock deposits. Okay, there's definite oxygen in the atmosphere now, and it's getting caught, combined with iron, and you're getting significant deposits. Okay, remember how they said that, in the past there wasn't enough oxygen to be really producing those kind of deposits.
So where's it coming from?
Again, you have a certain initial level of those cyanobacteria,
okay,
right, that are producing oxygen, and it was going along at a certain basic level, and they've said, all right, ramp it up. So
more bacteria.
Most likely, that means that they had the power, the associate, the primary associators. That type of master physical controller, they had them build more of their little machines, and the life carriers were there, and so they became living. Obviously the things are multiplying, but if you're going to ramp it up, you probably have to get a whole bunch more in play. They definitely did. Things really are kicking off now with the oxygen atmosphere, and it's fully in play precisely when they get to the point of getting eukaryotic life started. Okay, so, but see, they're studying, they're studying the physical conditions, they've got to take into account the special things that have to be in play relative to their experiment. Right? So it's not just the normal things that have to be in play, but a bunch of special things, too, that we obviously don't understand the details of. But, like I said, there's like more things to scrutinize and assess the progress of than normal. Okay, so that's what's in play. So very much this, it matches right up with the geologic record. Just as you might suspect, something new began to be in definitive evidence at the actual date of 600 million years ago.
It should be made clear that life carriers cannot initiate life until a sphere is ripe for the inauguration of the evolutionary cycle. Neither can we provide for a more rapid life development than can be supported and accommodated by the physical progress of the planet.
Okay, one thing I've already been stressing, right, is the wholeness of the evolutionary process. Okay, so they're reminding you that again. It's to all be one system. But notice the one key little thing in there, and that's an important line to remember. We have life on the planet right now, right? We have prokaryotic life. Right? So this life establishment that we're talking about in the title of the paper, that's eukaryotic life, right, that's going to get established. And it's evolutionary life. See, they gave you that specifically, right? You already have non-evolutionary life in play, but they're looking for it to be ripe for the inauguration of the evolutionary cycle. Eukaryotic life is evolutionary life. Do you have?
Well, it's just inauguration day.
Yeah. Yep.
Yes.
Yep, so...
Good catch, Gene. Just a coincidence.
Mm-hmm. All right, but a lot of people have been confused, readers of the book have been confused about this issue, thinking that, remember, it's 550 million years ago when they actually do this, so 50 million years from what we're reading about right now, thinking that is the beginning of all life. No, that's just the beginning. That's the inauguration of the evolutionary cycle. Right? And and it's very definitive that life is here before, not right in these two paragraphs, but that's why we went back, carefully noticed. It was put on the life registries already, right? Right? So we figured that out. Right? You've got prokaryotic life, the machines that are terraforming the planet. Right, and are going to be working behind the scenes, and then the actual evolutionary stuff that we haven't gotten to yet. Yep.
Do you think the iron was relatively free iron and not in some other kind of compound?
Well, yeah, the iron would have been involved in a lot of different things, but it's now getting oxidized.
When we have meteors, they have iron in them,
right? Right, obviously there can be, iron coming in from meteorites and stuff, that is basically raw iron. But also it's involved in other things, this stuff is going to be, oxygen is aggressive and it's going to grab a hold of this stuff and, it's going to make compounds with iron.
Yeah.
Right, and you're going to form these banded iron formations, they're called. Very definitive banded iron formations. Begin with them, turning up the volume on the process right here. What's actually 600 million years ago.
Do you know if there's any significant red rocks that are not attributed to iron?
Basically, when you see red beds, you're talking about from iron oxides.
Yeah. Rose quartz.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Where I grew up, there.
Right.
Red rocks, just like up here.
Yeah. That's Triassic formation stuff, right? That was laid down. Yeah. Yeah. We haven't got to the Triassic yet, but. So this is very early on that you're getting iron, in deposits.
What was the multiplier for that?
4 by 4. Right. Okay. Right. See, so it's 2.4 billion is what the radiometric date, is. Okay.
The Satania life carriers had projected a sodium chloride pattern of life. Therefore, no steps could be taken towards planting it until the ocean waters had become sufficiently briny. The Urantia type of protoplasm can function only in a suitable salt solution. All ancestral life, vegetable and animal, evolved in a salt solution habitat. And even the more highly organized land animals could not continue to live did not this same essential salt solution circulate throughout their bodies in the bloodstream, which freely bathes, literally submerses every tiny living cell in this briny deep.
Right, so the external briny deep gets internalized. You see how all these things that, they said before that you didn't really have, salty oceans. Okay, now we're definitely getting salty oceans, and we didn't have iron oxide deposits being laid down. Now we have, things are definitely moving forward toward what needs to be, think about again this synchronization process. It can't be; it has to be a certain saltiness, that they're looking for. All right, start to think, we'll really get to that when we get to the next section. Start to really think about how many non-coincidences, have to be in play. Right? The planet's being terraformed, already. So it's not, what's going on is not just quote-unquote natural. And in that artificial, mind-made and personality-managed process is all of this synchronizing. Such and so physical aspect needs to be just so. Not too little, not too large, right? Not too small, not too large. Not too hot, not too cold, not too whatever, right? There's all of these sweet spots. And the sweet spot varies from world to world. Remember, way back we read the paper where there's all kinds of variation in the kind of life that they implant on worlds. Right? So every sweet spot is different from world to world. Okay, and so you've got some certain sweet spot here, plus all of these additional things that are somehow going to be subtly involved in the fact that it's a decimal world. So there's the modifications that they're making go the way they want to go. So all these issues of quote unquote coincidentally, things are what they need to be. No, right? They've seen to it that this all matches up very precisely. So it's not the magical process that current scientists think. All right.
Was this briny setup? Consequential to the terraforming, or was that already going to forming it on its own?
I don't know, See, that's a job for scientists, to dig in and try to figure out, well, can they, can they account for, you know, everything that they see in a certain natural state or process by sort of obvious means, or is there a mystery there somewhere? You know, eventually that's what you know, the way we'll understand our world. We'll understand what happened sort of quote-unquote naturally, and what parts of what we have right now is only there because the power beings or whatnot see to it being that way. You know, either saw to it getting that way and it and sort of naturally will stay that way, or, you know, they see to maintaining it that way.
That's a lot all of these issues.
Right, all these issues.
Salt, that much water.
Yeah.
A lot of sodium chloride.
Yep.
I would guess that it was a matter of time for the, once there was land, for the salt to leach out of the
right,
continent.
Right. You've got all those issues, right? Of it just, you know, eventually leaching out of the land and, you know, and, but obviously, you know, even current scientists know there's a lot of complexity to all these processes. You know, scientists don't even remotely understand all the details of all these various processes. It's very, very complicated.
You know, oceans are saltier today than they were then.
Right. And, you know, the saltiness increases with time, you know, and they have to take that into account, you know. I mean, it's not going to get to a certain point and just stay spot on that, you know, as time goes forward. I mean, so, right, all this, all the things that they're designing with the life has to match up with a dynamic system, right? You know, it's not some simple, you know, the magic man makes it a certain way and then maintains it exactly in that spot. No, it's a dynamic system.
And not all of this is experimental. A lot of this has happened on a lot of
things. Right.
Experimental is only they're allowed to do a few things experimental.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, so just all those things are potentials for science going forward, you know, recognizing that just kind of be on the lookout for, I wonder if maybe this mystery is a deep mystery where you can't solve this without, you know, beings being in play. You know, you don't want to immediately jump to that. I mean, that was the big step we made in getting science going. It's not just saying, well, there's nothing natural. It's all just, you know, the guy with the magic wand. So we need to just back off a little bit, you know, and saying, yes, well, occasionally, yeah, there are beings involved, you know, and and you're going to have a hard time putting that into your equation, okay? Because you don't know the parameters. Okay, let's keep going.
There is truth.
Yeah, right.
If you look for it, and right. God created the earth.
Right. Some of those old ideas of a very, you know, micromanagey God, right? They aren't fact. They aren't a fact, but there's a truth there.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. Okay.
Your primitive ancestors freely circulated about in the salty ocean. Today, this same ocean-like salty solution freely circulates about in your bodies, bathing each individual cell with a chemical liquid in all essentials comparable to the salt water which stimulated the first protoplasmic reactions of the first living cells to function on the planet.
Remember, you got to have electrochemistry here, right? Okay. And is it just see how they're delighting in giving you these reciprocal things, you know, and how, you know, you have emotion, you know, is the organism circling about, or is, you know, is it circling about within the organism, right? But, you know, you have this definite motion, and the motion is just being internalized. Okay. And so they're trying to give you the, you know, the beauty, the symmetry of it, and, you know, and just appreciate how, you know, they've taken all into account, how that will all happen, you know, that it will get internalized, and so it's effectively still as it was way back when it was a single cell, you know, single-celled plant moving about in the ocean. So all these, you know, these amazing things that they take into account.
Yeah. But as this era opens, Urantia is in every way evolving toward a state favorable for the support of the initial forms of marine life. Slowly but surely, physical developments on Earth and in adjacent space regions are preparing the stage for the later attempts to establish such life forms as we had decided would be best adapted to the unfolding physical environment, both terrestrial and spatial.
Okay, so the thing they're throwing in there is, yeah, there's two things, terrestrial and spatial. That's why we have two subsequent sections. You know, the next section is going to bring in some issues about the quote-unquote terrestrial environment, and then the next subsequent section, the quote-unquote spatial environment. There's not only the fullness of terraforming the planet, but there's the whole background environment that this solar system exists in, then and going forward in time.
Not just the air we breathe is talking about.
No, they're not talking about the, you know, that's the terrestrial. That's the air we breathe. Okay. They're talking about specifically what we'll get into is the sub-electronic energy environment. That this solar system was in and would move into subsequently and will continue to move into as time goes forward, right? That sub-electronic energy environment is not constant with space and time, and they have to take that all into account. You know, again, physics that we know nothing about right now, right? In some ways, they're talking, you know, they're indicating they have to take into account a whole bunch of details that are in the domain of physics that we basically understand exists. We just don't understand all the, you know, the minutiae of all this. But there's also a vast aspect, you know, of physics that's more fundamental than we currently understand.
And it all comes into play.
Again, just to remind you that it's the whole system, not just the most immediate elements, but everything. All the way down to automatons, and you know, the whole spectrum, all is in play. You know, and a lot of it's not directly in play with life, but everything is indirectly in play with everything. Okay? That's what we're trying to get at. We have a tendency to think in very, you know, just upfront terms. You know, that we only have to take into account just the immediate interacting parts. Say, you know, it's like no, it's a system. You have, you know, they have to take into account in some subtle way what's going on in another super universe. Right?
Really?
Right? Because that feeds into the whole, and they exist in the whole. Right? All, like I said, I mean, that's one of the big things that, you know, about doing running these tests every roughly 10 worlds, you know, is trying to get a pin down these things that are very non-local, that are relevant to what they're doing, right? You know, you can't just carve out a space where, you know, you've got an impenetrable boundary, you know, and you're just playing around inside that, right? You know, the whole finite process of the entire grand universe, you know, has some role in what's going on. One big organism, right? Because it's a being, right? 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 The grand, you know, yeah, fundamentally every universe, that every one turning is an organism, right? You know, in terms of down in the finite, it's a whole, it's an organism because there's a mother that's ubiquitous throughout that, you know, and makes it effectively an organism. Right? Okay, so. All right, so that's what they're alluding to there is just, you know, the two sections that are coming up that they're going to give us a little taste of, as you know, without you know, going beyond what we can understand or what they can talk about.
Subsequently, the Satania Commission of Life Carriers returned to Jerusalem, preferring to await the further breakup of the continental landmass, which would afford still more inland seas and sheltered bays, before actually beginning life implantation.
Ah, okay. So they're assessing and they finally decide, no, not yet. You know, it sounds like, you know, if they'd checked things out, you know, maybe they would have gone back then. But no, it's going to be basically another 50 million years before they, you know, quote unquote, inaugurate the evolutionary cycle. Okay. And this brings up, you know, see, this touches back on, remember what was happening, like I said at the beginning, right before, at the end of the previous paper. You know, fundamentally what's in play they're talking about here is that breaking up, right, of the initial single continent. And remember last week, we never got back around to it. The question came up when we saw 750 million years ago, you know, the first breaks in the continental landmass began, you know, dot, dot, dot. You know, and the question was, okay, are they talking about Pangaea? You know, is this the single continent, quote unquote, Pangaea, breaking up? And I said, no, it's not. So let's, you know, now that they're mentioning it again here, let's follow that up. When they first, at the beginning of the 20th century, when people were first thinking about, you know, basically Wegener, was first thinking about the idea of continental drift. You're looking at what's going on the planet right now, and extrapolating those processes, those movements back in time. Okay, now remember how I was stressing, what's going on right now is plate tectonics, technically, not continental drift the way the relators are really using it as a distinct process from plate tectonics, quote unquote. If you look at the plate tectonic phenomenon that we have on the planet right now, and you go back, you know, run the camera, you know, back in time, run the film backwards, you know, it goes back to a point where the continents come together in a single landmass. Okay, and that's Pangaea, and that's very recent.
Pangaea was the name of that?
That was the name given to what you discovered that we're not the current separated continents, and you run the, you know, the time backwards, it comes back together into a single one, okay?
Jigsaw.
Okay, that single one, you see, is just extrapolating plate tectonics back.
And that's called Pangaea.
That right? Single. And that's kind of back there, you know, sort of in the, you know, is plate tectonics is, you know, what the process that broke up that single mass going forward. And that's in relatively recent times. Okay, this is way before that. See, we're talking about way, way before that quote-unquote Pangaea, that extrapolation of plate tectonics backward. Right? You're going back to when the plate, you didn't have rigid plates and things were flexing about. And they're pointing out, yeah, way, way, way back, there was a single landmass. It wasn't broken apart by plate tectonics and then, you know, brought forward to now. See, that whole breaking that Pangaea apart and going to now doesn't take very long. It's a very recent thing. This is way, way back relative to that. Okay. Right, so this is this is not quote-unquote Pangaea. This is a way former single landmass. You know, and the very fact that you had this transition from where the crust is more plastic and flexing about, quote-unquote continental drift, you know, and then eventually really getting solidified hard and then, you know, having plate tectonics added. You know, again, what are the scientists doing right now? They're basically assuming plate tectonics goes way, 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 way back, and they're, you know, they're extrapolating back and it's together and then it's apart again. And, you know, I mean, they're running
the continental drift too, don't they, in a way?
Not anymore. I mean, originally it was called continental drift, but now they call it plate tectonics. Okay. See, and that's what I'm saying. You're reading this and you're going, oh, the relators are just talking about plate tectonics. It's just a synonym, continental drift. No, it's not. You need to recognize, even though it's a synonym for every human alive, it's not a synonym for the relators. And if you're just a helpless victim of the ignorance of others, you'll misinterpret the revelation. Right? You got to recognize as you're reading, it's like, wait a minute. This is describing something that's not properly plate tectonics. There aren't rigid plates here. There's no mountain building going on. Right? It's a long time before you have rigid plates and you get mountain building, you know, the way we think of mountain building now. Right? So all of this stuff that's going on, see, is before that. And so think about how inaccurate their extrapolations are, where they try to take plate tectonics back all the way to the beginning of the planet. Right? You know, it's not even going to go back as far as they think to Pangaea. I mean, back in Pangaea times, you know, you were still in the transition from something that was more plastic to something that was rigid. See, so their extrapolation breaks down really. You know, and so if they show you a picture of Pangaea, it's like, you know, take that with a grain of salt, okay? because they're extrapolating beyond the, you know, the validity of their extrapolation.
But don't tell them, because they don't want to.
That's where the salt came from.
Okay. See, I'm just, you know, just trying to get you to appreciate the challenge of reading a revelation, right? You can't be subject to what every religionist and every scientist and every philosopher has said. You've got to transcend all that. You've got to approach the revelation from the top down. If you approach it from the bottom up, you'll put new wine in old wineskins and you won't get revelation. Right? You'll get at best confusion, and if you're more earnest, you'll eventually have no choice but to conclude that the book is just pure drivel. Right? Because this is not going to match.
It's either that or too hard to understand.
Yeah.
You're doing it either way. Right? I'm just, for somebody like me who doesn't necessarily, when I went to school, my little drift was there, you know, plate tectonics, it was just coming on, you know, so for me, it has a different meaning because I haven't been studying it since then.
And again, I mean,
so it's hard sometimes to actually, as you say, see where they're trying to tell you something that, you know, is more definitive, and when sometimes when they're not.
Yeah. And it's going to get even trickier when we read the next section.
Okay.
Right? You think you've got it all figured out from what we're saying right now. It's like, well, no, except that doesn't apply to the next section.
Surprise, surprise.
You have to be really on your toes, you know, and the challenge is to somehow approach the words on the page objectively. To approach them not subject to anything you've ever heard, including all that stuff that you've never even, don't even know that you, is in your mind. All that unconscious framework that you think in, right? It's a huge challenge. So again, like I said, I mean, you just go forward very humbly and think long term. You know, if you can maintain some humility, maybe, you know, once you find the book after 10 years, maybe some of the log jam will start to loosen a little bit in your mind. But expect, you know, long time scales for the process. It's very difficult. All right. So that's the Pangaea thing. Just to clean up that loose end. All right.
On a planet where life has a marine origin, the ideal conditions for life implantation are provided by a large number of inland seas, by an extensive shoreline of shallow waters and sheltered bays. And just such a distribution of the Earth's waters was rapidly developing. These ancient inland seas were seldom over 500 or 600 feet deep, and sunlight can penetrate ocean water for more than 600 feet.
Hmm. Coincidentally.
Oh, really?
See? Do you see what they're doing? I'm really stressing this because this is the key thing. I mean, the specifics are not, you know, they didn't mobilize a super universe to tell you that ocean water can be penetrated by sunlight for over 600 feet. Okay, that's not the point.
Though I didn't know that personally.
But you could have looked it up on Wikipedia.
If I want, you know.
See?
Better reason to, right?
Right? That's not the point. Right? See, so what is the point? Well, that's the only thing that I was taught in school, is to look for facts like that and memorize them. Well, then you're hopelessly ill-prepared for a revelation. Because it's not about those issues first. Right? What you want to recognize first is, why are they telling me this? What's the point?
Because these were deep rifts.
Right? You don't have very deep rifts, right? I mean, you know, I mean, again, see, I think about how that fits into, you know, you're just kind of, you know, oozing things apart of this sort of plastic thing. You don't have plates that are definitively rifting apart, okay, and this sort of thing. Right, so that fits in what I was saying before. But again, just they're trying to point out this wonderful dance, right? You know, they're going to put single-celled plants in the water, okay? And if immediately they just, you know, sink down into the dark and die, that's not going to work. and everything needs to be so set up.
It was only 600 feet.
They've got to, you know, they're working, you know, synchronizing this all up. They're just giving you a few trivial little examples that we can comprehend, you know, like sunlight penetrating the ocean, right? But there's millions of things like that that all have to match up for it to work. That's what they're trying to get you to think about, is just how precisely they're going to synchronize the life implantation with the physical world. Okay? They've modified the life to match the world. You know, every world has a little different physical evolution. That's why, like we said, that's why there's all those variations in the kind of life that's implanted. Right? It's not just because they want to have a whole bunch of different variations of life.
So it couldn't be further.
There's a lot of different worlds. And certain kinds of life can't be put on certain kinds of worlds. Yeah. Right?
Couldn't be further than being an accident. It's almost absurd how much detail
there
is.
There are no coincidences in supremacy. You know, coincidentally, one of the kind of lives that you can make, there happens to be worlds that just match that kind of life. I mean, did they build this world from scratch? No. And we've just been reading. Seemed to come together by just a chaotic random process, right? Supremacy, there are no coincidences. And coincidentally, there's a kind of life that that you can put together that fits in just so with this planet, right? And lots of other planets, right? That's what, and their creativity is coming up with, this world here, it seems like it's kind of in the ballpark, but, we've never designed life for a world like that before. You suppose there's a variation in the way we do things that would match up with that kind of a world? And the answer is, a lot of times, yes. Right? So you think the evolution of the Supreme, you know, which is overarching all this complicated physical evolution, okay, gives rise to certain worlds. And coincidentally, life carriers have just enough creativity to design life for those worlds that just happen to evolve into existence. This whole wonderful system, to see it in its wholeness like that, right? It reminds you, when Jesus said to the apostles, don't worry about what you're going to say when a situation comes to you, you'll be able to, you'll have the creativity to think on your feet and meet the moment. The whole universe is like that. Right? Yeah, the life carriers were told, don't worry. Right? When the challenges come in front of you, you'll dig deep and you'll find that, wow, I actually had the creativity as a life carrier to design life for that world. It seemed like that world should be inhabited, but it wasn't immediately apparent that it could be until I was challenged to dig deeper. Right? That's the whole experiment. I mean, it's not just decimal worlds that are experimental worlds. The entire evolutionary process, the entire finite is a test like this. Right? And when humans get too complacent, right, we get nudged. Right? We need to be challenged to dig deep and find creativity we've never tapped into before, to meet circumstances that we thought couldn't be met. Right? We love to write stories about that, our surprise that actually we could meet, we could do what we thought was impossible. Right? And that's an important thing to remember. Right? Very few things are impossible if we really set our minds to it and if we work together. You know, as humans, everything is impossible for sedate animals, right? Fancy animals. But you shouldn't ever, short-circuit, you know, yourself in relationship to the potentials. You know, if you really try, right, don't be defeatist, you know. And so, see, there's a lesson here, and it's between the lines, and it's a universal lesson. All celestial beings have to meet this challenge, and we do too. You know, and you can't run from the challenge. You know, if you don't rise to the challenge, the creative challenge here, you'll face it on the first mansion world.
Probably for a long time.
And probably for a long time, right?
That's kind of okay. Nice, though.
We have vast untapped potential as a people, right? And we need to be challenged to dig deep and find that, you know, that well again. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So on a planet where life has a marine origin.
No, you read that one, yeah.
Okay. I'm just trying to make the class go longer.
No, that's my job.
Okay,
you just read.
And it was from such seashores of mild and equitable climes of a later age that primitive plant life form found its way onto the land. There, the high degree of carbon in the atmosphere afforded the new land varieties of life opportunity for speedy and luxuriant growth. Though this atmosphere was then ideal for plant growth, it contained such a high degree of carbon dioxide that no animal, much less man, could have lived on the face of the earth.
And he didn't have to back then because there's not time for man yet. But coincidentally, and like remember I pointed out, if a planet isn't terraformed, it naturally has lots of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And I was like, well, that seems like something, you know, why would that be? I mean, you know, we want oxygen and nitrogen, you know, that seems to be an extraneous thing that, you know, seems to be like a mistake of physical evolution. No, it has its place.
Yeah, plant life.
Right? All right, plant life needs that early on. You know, not only does it need it, but the subsequent animal life is going to need more oxygen in the atmosphere than the cyanobacteria can put into the atmosphere, and it all fits together. You know, yeah, whatever you need subsequently in the evolutionary process, coincidentally, is there beforehand. Right? This is the lesson they're trying to teach. There's no coincidence to this. It's all set up, right? Just like Jesus tried to teach the apostles. Don't worry, you know, it's all been put in place before you.
As long as we don't cut down all
just,
the forests.
Just notice what's there. Right? Well,
I'm teasing.
Yeah. Okay. Right? Just, you know, and think about, you know, when we get, you know, to that part of the story, when we talk about all that plant life pulling all that carbon out of the atmosphere and sequestering it down in the ground, right? You know they're going to call that period the Carboniferous, the carbon-bearing age. You know, and it's like, well, that's just, you know, what happens. It has no purpose. It has no meaning. No. Right? It wouldn't happen if it wasn't a precursor to what comes later. Eventually, there'll be humans, and they'll need energy. Huh. Look at that. The energy was given to them before they needed it. Right? It's all part of a process.
So they're going to put the carbon back out, back in the air.
Yeah. Because maybe that's needed for some subsequent thing then, right? See, I mean, it's all a system, right? Everything that happened back in the Andromeda Nebula conforms with their eventually being will creatures, right? And light and life, you know, can be had by will creatures with all of their needs when they're primitive and all this. You know, it's all a system. Trust in the system, you know? These are the big lessons they're trying to teach, is to challenge humanism, right? You know, humans are not the whole. We're a part in a vast, beautiful system.
I believe there's two inhabited planets in the solar system. Conditions are set for tremendous super habitat.
Yes.
And since our development has been delayed, they're probably having, in a way, kind of stand by and just watch us. But think about how intriguing it must be for them to look at our developing planet.
Yeah, and again, right? I mean, if it is a case, like for those in the webinar, he was bringing up, if we have another inhabited world, right? If that speculation is valid, that we actually have two inhabited worlds in the solar system, that's all part of the plan back here too, right? Right? They're designing life on this planet, and then the whole process, it's fundamentally dependent upon that eventual super additive consequence of the two worlds coming together, right? It means we aren't complete into ourselves. Eventually, we're dependent upon that other world for both of us to go forward. We're designed that way, right? From the get-go. The life carriers are designing the life on that world, too, right now, as we're reading this story. It's the same time that they're designing it for here. They're also going to that other world and doing whatever they need for that. And right, it's all together.
We're in the same group.
Right. So there's all these issues. You think about how amazing this is and how much, we don't know what we're talking about when we think, well, this absolutely has to be done, or there's no way humans can go forward. You got to trust a lot more because we just, we're very ignorant right now. All right. Okay. So now before we read... this next section, I need to preface it. So this is one of those interesting sections where they have, they're very much playing off of, a tidy little human article, human source. Okay. And it's an interesting one, just like back there when they're talking about atomic cohesion. They're drawing from a human source in that post 1935 phase. So after you basically have everything all in play, long after part three here is basically all in place, they've added this section, or at least they've radically modified whatever they had there before, which we don't know what it was, if it was something. Because this is playing off of an article that was written in June of 1942. So probably one of the very last things before, they really let go of it and put it in the hands of the Contact Commission to go forward. Okay, very, very late on. They've constructed a section here leveraging off of that article. And all you have to do is look at the title of that article. And I don't need to give you the exact title, but just I'll paraphrase it, what the title is about to see what we're getting at here. The article is about the influence of the sun on the atmosphere. Okay. And you'll see how they're going to be playing off of that point here, is that how they use various aspects of that article. They want to get us to fundamentally recognize how dependent the Earth is on the specifics of the sun, and how much precision there is to this whole synchronizing that we've been talking about here, of synchronizing life up to the physical system. It's not just the Earth in and of itself, but the whole solar system. And a very important object in that solar system is the star, the sun, right? Here's an example where you've got a lot of facts that are basically just in that article. So that's not the point. And see that, and knowing, finding the human source work, kind of just stresses that. Oh, okay, so it's the basic facts are just there. So it's not like they're disclosing facts that we can't figure out ourselves. And okay, that's not the point. They're saying, okay, you think like this. What kind of a truth can you get from this thought? And notice how I've used this human source work, what I've used, what I haven't used, how I modified what I did use, etc. We won't get into all those details, okay? I'll just give you the spirit of them as we go forward here. But see, this is a passage where you're very much looking through the immediate facts to some truth. I mean, that's always the case, but it's very much so when you have a section like this where they're taking the way humans are talking about something in a scientific, factual way, and trying to play off of that to greater ends. So you know, we'll read it, we'll see the facts, but we'll say, okay, but the point is not the facts. What are they trying to get at here? Why did they invoke those facts in that article? What's the point? Okay, so let's read the first paragraph here.
To the Urantia atmosphere. The planetary atmosphere filters through to the Earth about 1/2 billionth of the sun's total light emanation. If the light falling upon North America were paid for at the rate of 2 cents per kilowatt hour, the annual light bill would be upward of $800 quadrillion. Chicago's bill for sunshine would amount to considerably over $100 million a day. And it should be remembered that you receive from the sun other forms of energy. Light is not the only solar contribution reaching your atmosphere. Vast solar energies pour in upon your rancha, embracing wavelengths ranging both above and below the recognition range of human vision.
Okay. So curious analogies, you know, they're using here and whatnot. Okay, so just a little aside. You notice in that first sentence where you read about 1/2 billionth. The original is 1/2 billionths. And the argument is made that that's not proper. Well, that's a, you know, the original human article, you know, human source work says 1/2 billionths. See, so that's actually, you know, severing the tie to the human source work to change that. Again, like I said, I mean, there's subtle things. You know, you need to be cautious about what you think you should change and what you shouldn't. You know?
That was an early change.
Yeah.
Because this book doesn't have a lot of the other changes.
Right. I mean, it's just, you know, the argument is, well, that's not proper English. You know, it's like, yeah, but it's in the original article, and they're drawing a parallel, right? They want you to notice the parallel. Don't hide that. Okay, so there's that. So besides, what is that, you know, when you hear that, 1/2 billionths, okay, what does that say to you? Sun, very big, Earth, not so big, all right, I mean, you know, what are we talking about? The sun is putting out energy, you know, in every direction, you know, from its spherical surface, right, and way off, you know, in the distance, there's this tiny little circle that, you know, that a little pencil of that energy hits, you know, and the rest of it's going in other directions.
Sure feels like a lot when you're standing in a hot sundown.
Right, it does. Right? Okay. But they want you to reflect on that ratio. They gave you that ratio. You know, it's not the fact of the ratio that's important. What's the truth of that ratio? Okay. The truth is, all the sun has to do is just change in the most tiny, tiny amount. Okay. And it has a big impact on the Earth. Sun very big, Earth not so big, right? So, you know, we lose track of this. You know, we get all caught up in all the things that can be that are happening just within the Earth system, you know, and treat the sun like it's this fixed fact. No, it's a variable fact, you know, and if it changes a little bit, you know, in its terms, that's a big deal to us, okay?
Oh, I see.
Right? I mean, if like I've, like you've heard me say many times, if the sun wants the earth to be hot, the earth's going to be hot. If the sun wants the earth to be cold, the earth's going to be cold. And there isn't anything that the earth could do to change that fact, or any humans could do to change that fact, right? Yes, humans and earth processes can have an impact. Okay, but the elephant in the room is the sun, right?
We really want to control the climate. We've got to get a hold of the knobs.
We put some water on the sun. Right?
If you want to make sure that you lock the earth, you know, in its so-called current divine state eternally, you got to somehow pin the sun down. Good luck.
Happen someday.
Right, but we won't do it. The power beings will do it, right? In the fifth stage of light and life or whatever.
That's an interesting thing. Okay. That would happen someday.
Right. Again, that's kind of right, and that's where we're going next. Okay, so all right, so then they take a couple of these analogies and tweak them a little bit from the human source work. They made it so it was kind of a tidier analogy. Instead of using the continental United States, and they used North America, and they wanted a nice clean 2 cents per kilowatt hour. So they tweaked it a little bit, like they tweak Bible passages. Okay, they tweaked it a little bit. So it's just kind of a cleaner analogy. The point is not exactly, how much upward of 800 quadrillion it is. I mean, okay, the fact is not, why would they basically repeat, slightly reworked, but basically repeat that from the human source work? What's it telling you?
It's astronomical.
It's like, whoa, okay, it's only 1-2 billionths, but, whoa.
That's a lot.
So, wow, the sun is really a lot bigger than the earth. Right? They're trying to drive this home. And they thought, oh, that statement in that article, that really helps. That'll further drive it home. And then in the same spirit as the human source work, bring it down to something that's, quadrillions, what does that mean? Something that's a little bit more approachable. But the human source work said Greater New York. We're revealing this in Chicago. How about if we change it to Chicago? Right. It's a fun little inside thing there, see? it doesn't matter, big city. All right, so they tweaked it to Chicago. And they had to tweak it a little bit too because they changed the price, to 2 cents per kilowatt hour. But anyway, okay, it's basic. So it's just a further repeat, just stressing that in more approachable terms. Yeah, we're talking about very significant energy input. Okay, but relative to the sun, it's nothing.
Right.
Yeah, for us, it's like mind-bogglingly huge. For the sun, it's nothing. It's trivial, right? So, like I said, the sun blinks differently, and okay, and we're fried or frozen. Okay.
And we capture such a small amount of total radio output. Right. Mean, it's just.
So who controls that?
Okay, yeah. So we'll get to that.
Like it could happen.
We'll get to this in just a second. Okay. Okay, and then the last thing there is transitioning to the next paragraph. It's fun to see what they do. They like to pull these things out of the human source work because there was this nice little this leads to this, this leads to this, this leads to this that they could set up, kind of string these paragraphs together like this. So saying, oh, and remember, you don't just have visible light. You have infrared and ultraviolet too. Not to mention, longer wavelengths and shorter wavelengths, respectively. You have this whole spectrum of radiation. Okay, and they're going to be transitioning to where we're talking about ultraviolet. See, so that transitions. But let's go pick up your point, John, before we see how that's bringing up ultraviolet transitions to the next paragraph. I see. They're pointing out. Okay, this is. They have to have things, not just the planet, in a precise fashion. Like with 500 to 600 feet deep water and stuff like that. Right? But the sun has to be just so. And you're going, well, Well, that really makes me think, you know, I'll bet you right now there's probably some active regulation of the sun. Yeah, it hasn't been locked into its eternal state that it'll eventually be locked into where it's completely controlled. But I'm suspecting that there's probably already some stuff going on right now. Remember, you know that the sun is actually more massive than we think it is because just the anti-gravity presence, right, of the mechanical controllers in the solar system makes it appear to be less massive than it actually is.
Yeah.
Right, so there's a modification of our of how the influence of the sun on the Earth right there. How many other things are being modified besides just that basic gravity, you know, anti-gravity presence issue? How many other things are the power beings doing? You know?
And this is happening all over the universe to all the other...
Right. Yeah, any inhabited solar system, right?
Has to happen.
See, they're not laying out any details. They're just trying to remind you of how silly we are to be running around with our hair on fire, the sky is falling and stuff, right? I mean, just how much control has to be there for the most basic things, right? You know, and we're thinking, we've got to somehow control all this. It's like, no, it's already being controlled, right? We don't have to figure out how to be sovereign of the external world. There already is a sovereign of the external world.
Yeah.
And they're on the job all the time. Yep. Yeah.
A couple other things, you know, it's these dollar amounts, it's, I mean, our efforts to
find
and utilize energy is, there's a lot of effort involved.
Mm-hmm.
In here, the apparent profligacy of the creators is just mind-boggling.
Right.
I mean, we only need this little bit of energy that the compared to what all the sun puts out, why create a solar system, a system where there's so much waste, in human terms,
right.
It appears that it's all
as if the sun is just for us, right? You know, yeah, all that stuff that seems to be wasted that's going off in other directions besides where we are, well, there's other things in the universe besides us. Right? Right? Yeah.
But it still doesn't mean, you know, like, for instance, there are things that we do as humans, like burn a lot of stuff in the atmosphere that makes it very difficult to breathe. You know, so it doesn't mean that
Of course, kinds of, you know, right, we bring this up every time.
There's a happy medium.
Can we talk about all this without you feeling your dichotomy tension? Oh, he's saying humans should be irresponsible. Of course I'm not. And I'm just trying to get us to be wisely, you know, responsible.
You gave me that.
Right? We all, for 2,000 years, you know, since this, you know, the spiritual uplift that we, you know, we got at Pentecost, you know, we are very conscientious. Okay, that's not a problem. You know, inescapably we're conscientious, but we're very unwise.
Yeah.
We have all this zeal and no wisdom. Right? We need to get the big picture in hand. What do we need to worry about, and what don't we need to worry about? Right? We don't need to worry about saving the universe or the world. You know, but you can improve, you know, the air in your local environment. Okay. Again, see, that's what they're trying to get you. It's like, how much effort would humans have to expend to produce enough energy where someone would have to pay you $800 quadrillion for that energy? How much human effort would that require?
At 2 cents.
Right. See,
yeah. Right. Can't be cheap.
We need to focus on stuff that's bite-sized for humans.
Yeah.
Right? And do that well. Do our part well. And stop thinking we're God and we have to save the universe. Okay. All right. So now we transition. We're going to pick up on the ultraviolet thing. What do they say here?
The Earth's atmosphere is all but opaque to much of the solar radiation at the extreme ultraviolet end of the spectrum. Most of these short wavelengths are absorbed by a layer of ozone, which exists throughout a level about 10 miles above the surface of the Earth. and which extends spaceward for another 10 miles. The ozone permeating this region, at conditions prevailing on the Earth's surface, would make a layer only 1/10 of an inch thick. Nevertheless, this relatively small and apparently insignificant amount of ozone protects Urantia inhabitants from the excess of these dangerous and destructive ultraviolet radiations present in sunlight. But were this ozone layer just a trifle thicker, you would be deprived of the highly important and health-giving ultraviolet rays which now reach the Earth's surface and which are ancestral to one of the most essential of your vitamins.
Which would be vitamin
D.
D, obviously, right.
Duh.
Right. See, and just notice how they, you know, they left you to fill in the blank there.
This is interesting.
Okay, so, all right, so you basically have what's in the human source work tidied up a little bit so that it, you know, it isn't unnecessarily bogged down by, you know, limited thought back there in 1942. Okay, but the facts, you know, are not the biggie. You know, the point is not to tell you that about 10 miles up it starts, you know, and goes up for another 10 miles. Okay, that's not the immediate point. You can see from the end what the point is. You have this, if you have too little, it's a problem. You have too much, it's a problem. It has to be just so. And the just so of it is this very complex, precise synchronization of the sun's relationship to the earth and the nature of the earth as a receiver for that relationship, you know, that influence from the sun. All that has to be, you know, and again, there's millions of things like this. They're just giving us a simple example that they can draw from a human source work and play off of.
So this isn't necessarily okay. Revelation that we couldn't figure out.
No, I mean, this is from the human source work. This is all basically in the human source work.
Okay.
Right? We'd already discovered the ozone layer, and you know, so they're just playing off of that. See, again, they're not. It isn't about disclosing facts. You know, very much when you've got a sort of kind of closely paralleled human source work like it, it's definitely not about the disclosure of facts. They're trying. What's the truth of what's being
definitely
said?
Blind man is
okay. Do are you going to have life like us without an ozone layer? No. Oh, well, coincidentally, an ozone layer was in existence before, you know, life was there. And do you suppose they maybe are involved, you know, in its maintenance some, too? I never considered that. I know we're trying to make sure we don't, you know, do things to destroy the ozone layer. And we get very worked up about it, and maybe we should be, you know, concerned, but do you suppose that the sovereigns of the external world are on that? And coincidentally, whether we think we came up with the idea or whatever, the problem never gets very serious.
But maybe they're on it by having us think about it.
Right, that's what I was just saying.
Oh, okay.
That's what I was just saying.
Oh, okay, I missed that.
See, that's one of the way the Most High is, for instance, work, you know, as the over-controllers of political evolution. Right? You know, you don't go, whoa, these beings just entered in and changed our political situation. No, it doesn't work like that. They're very crafty at this. Humans all think that, you know, we all came up with the ideas and everything, and it just happens to come out the way it needs to come out.
Right.
Right? That's the usual modus operandi. Just knowing that that's the case, that the way they usually want to fix problems is get you to be the hands.
Yeah.
Well, if you know they know the solution and you don't, but you are humble and open to be the hands, the means for that end, maybe this will all work better.
It can work.
Instead of thinking, no, I am the God that knows all, and you know, and I should decide what's right and not. See, you know, we need to stop that. We need to be means to an end. We need to think about that. We are the immediate hands that steward the earth in many ways. Right? But we're not the boss.
Yeah.
And we're certainly ignorant. You know, and so, you know, you can see they take the things out of the human source birth that really make the point, you know, like bringing in the tenth of an inch, right? If you bring it down to the temperature and pressure at the surface of the Earth, that ozone is, it's like, whoa, that's not very much stuff. Yeah, your whole existence is dependent upon something that tenuous.
Yeah.
And it has to be just so.
And ozone is what,
O1? O3.
O3, okay.
Right? Instead of regular O2. Yeah. O3. Okay.
And it has properties that are just so.
Right.
It's just right. Unstable enough to do what it does.
All these things, right?
That's crazy.
Right. Coincidentally, there's a molecule that works for this. Did any of these beings design that molecule? No, coincidentally, that just works out naturally in the way atoms are designed. And I see all this stuff, you know. Coincidentally, there's an atom called carbon that works really great for being the base for organic molecules and all this stuff. I'm just trying to get you to think about it, how this all works together as a system.
And at some point it might occur to you, this just can't be random.
Yeah, maybe. It will eventually occur to you, this just can't be random.
James Hawking.
All right, so again... like I said, in terms of the facts, you know, if you look at the human source work, you can just see how occasionally they'll tweak things slightly so that they work as a more general statement. But that's not the point, right? The facts are a means to a greater end of truth, and that's what they want you to really reflect on. And if it isn't clear already, it is when they throw in the next paragraph, which has nothing to do with the human source work, right? They throw in this paragraph of their own.
And yet... some of the less imaginative of your mortal mechanists insist on viewing material creation and human evolution as an accident. The Urantia Midwayers have assembled over 50,000 facts of physics and chemistry, which they deem to be incompatible with the laws of accidental chance, and which they contend unmistakably demonstrate the presence of intelligent purpose in the material creation. And all of this takes no account of their catalog of more than 100,000 findings outside the domain of physics and chemistry, which they maintain prove the presence of mind in the planning, creation, and maintenance of the material cosmos.
Okay. All right, so you see they're throwing it in. And yet, some of the less imaginative of your mortal mechanists... right. Why are you less imaginative? Because you're not much of a person. You're just a fancy animal. Right? Like I was, you know, stressing early on. No one is challenging themselves to go beyond their fancy animal consciousness and be genuinely imaginative and creative and recognize some truths. And... you know, they toss out these fascinating thoughts of over 50,000 facts, you know, and more than 100,000 findings, and you go, oh, let's see if we can figure them out. No, that's not the first step. That's a fact finder. Okay? And certainly someone who hasn't recognized the fundamental truth, that's the last thing they'd be doing is trying to see if they can create that list of 50,000 facts. So, you know, you get my point again. You can see it's the same point the Revelators are trying to make. Before you get into your facts, approach it from the framework of the whole, from the framework of the truth of the whole, right? That the universe is, you know, mind-made and personality-managed. Mind-planned, mind-made, and mind-administered.
It was made to be inhabited.
All these big truths. And you know, once that is firmly set in your consciousness as the framework in which all subsequent thought exists, okay, then get into the science or the religion. But first have the philosophic framework of truth, right? So that your efforts in religion or science have some hope of being true, of not being in vain, of not just being a game where you're playing with yourself. Okay. So that's the whole point. And so they're just using this human source work as a means to that end. That's an article that has some things we can work with. And the whole premise of the article is that the sun is has a big influence on the atmosphere. Okay, let's play off of that, and see if we can get the readers of this fifth epical revelation to recognize some truths. That some of your basic things that you knew there in the late 30s and early 40s allow us to leverage off of. All right, now, what they do in these next two little paragraphs is, in the spirit of this paragraph they just gave you, so they take you back to the human source work, and they say, for example, think about these two little snippets out of the human source work. Okay, so read that first one.
Your sun pours forth a veritable flood of death-dealing rays, and your pleasant life on your rancho is due to the fortuitous influence of more than 20 apparently accidental protective operations similar to the action of this unique ozone layer.
Okay, so that very last part, obviously, is the revelators have thrown in, right? The human author doesn't know anything about, the protective operations, twoscore apparently, right? Apparently accidental, right? And right there, again, you see. And the quote-unquote fortuitous is playing off of a statement in the human source work that says, boy, it sure is darn fortunate that dot-dot-dot. Yeah, fortunate, quote-unquote. Right? There's nothing fortunate. There's nothing accidental about it.
It's almost as though
the player is offended. Right? The life carriers are writing this, right?
Sarcasm.
Right? The life carriers, the ones that are here. Right? Yeah. No, we've synchronized everything. The planet is terraformed, and right, everything is very precisely artificially so. So they're just saying, just notice this one little simple thing in the human source work where he just sort of unwittingly, just said that. Boy, it sure is fortunate, da, 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 without even thinking about really what he was saying. But no, they're saying, think about that. How you can't let that seed grow in your mind. It takes you off into magic matter land. Right? That's where we are today. After 100 years of innocently letting little thoughts like that creep into our head, it's taken us to where now we believe in just a ubiquitous magic matter that does everything. Right? We replace the magic man with magic matter.
Meaning dark matter?
No, just the properties of matter. We assume matter has magical properties, right? Where matter inherently can just make life.
I got you.
Right? Dirt clods can get together and say, let us make life in our deeper image or something, right? I mean, no. That isn't how it worked.
We need a lightning bolt.
Right?
A little song.
Lightning.
And a lightning bolt.
Okay, so...
So what is an apparently accidental thing other than ozone?
Right, so there's a good question. See, then that takes you off into a scientific exploration.
Just
you,
out of curiosity.
And again, notice how, they're pointing out this balance. A little bit one direction and it's death.
Right.
Tweak it a little bit and it's indispensable to life. Oh, that reminds me of a lot of things in the universe. They can't give me creativity without giving me an equal measure of the potential for destructivity. Oh, everything in the universe is that way. Not just my personality, but all of creation is that way. Right? It can be used for good or for ill. And it's in the hands of those minds that are making and those personalities that are managing which way it goes. Right? Ozone isn't evil, right? Or good. It's just ozone. You know, and of course, you know, for instance, ozone is great when it's up there in the stratosphere and blocking these light. But if it's down here in this room, it's a poison.
It's like bleach.
Do you want an aggressive oxidizer, you know, bathing your body? Probably not. Okay, so you see, so that's what they're doing. The quote unquote is literally say, you know, like the article where he says, fortunate, quote unquote, see.
Few other things in that category.
Okay, and then he tosses out another one. It's a little different flavor to it.
Were it not for the blanketing effect of the atmosphere at night, heat would be lost by radiation so rapidly that life would be impossible of maintenance except by artificial provision.
It's like, okay, just the fact of the sentence, again, the fact of the sentence is there. It's not revelation. Okay, what and why did they go quote-unquote blanketing? So they're saying, now think about that author, that article, how, you know, he's just sort of trying to express his thoughts in a way that seems natural, and he had to use the word blanket to describe what he was thinking about or what he was observing, you know, the scientific fact that he was trying to describe. Notice, you catch yourself when you do that. You just use the word blanket to describe a supposedly totally natural system. Do blankets grow on trees?
No, but they have an effect.
You're missing the point. Do blankets grow on trees? Are they natural or artificial?
I've never seen a blanket grow on a tree.
No. I believe there has to be a loom.
Yeah.
And it has to be woven.
They grow on a sheep.
All right? They don't grow on sheep. Blankets don't grow on sheep.
I guess
wool grows on a sheep, not blankets.
Well, but skin or, you know.
No, no. See, no,
that's old blankets.
Think of the point, the word blanket. You know, we use it in analogy for, you know, the leaves blanketed the yard.
Right.
But that's not the root meaning. The word blanket is about that thing that you make on a loom. That's the root meaning of that word. It's an artificial fact that you use in metaphoric fashion, yes. But see, why is he's going, yeah. Notice he said blanket, okay? Blankets are engineered.
An artisan makes a blanket.
Yeah. Right, an artisan makes a blanket.
And they even use artificial provision.
Right. If he's trying to get you, just think about the words that you have to use to describe what you're observing. Like, you describe a eukaryotic cell. Notice the words the only words that you can come up to use to describe it. They're engineering words. You can't describe the eukaryotic cell in any other way. What is that telling you? That was engineered. An artisan engineered that. Right? The fact that you can't describe it in any other way is proof of that. It's trying to tell you the obvious. That's why he's quoting that. See, so two different quotes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's saying, notice that word and notice this word. What's that telling you? Right? See how the life carrier is using the human source work, trying to get you to reflect, to recognize. All these things that you just unwittingly do, the way you describe the world, you know, you describe it in ways that imply that there's a mind behind it. Recognize the obvious. Right? Blankets don't come into existence without minds.
Craftsman.
Right. Okay.
Except by artificial provision.
Okay. And then they throw in that little bit, just as a reminder, you know, not only to the immediate point of how the ozone layer, you know, is not just there coincidentally, quote unquote, right? But on a lot of worlds, there has to be a lot more artificial stuff than others. Like we've talked about, think about a non-breather world. I mean, everything about it is artificial, right? Or just nothing happens. Right, so there's this whole spectrum. Some worlds, the artificialness is completely obvious. No one could miss it, right? But every world has artificialness, and it's only our ignorance that makes us miss it. So, you know, this world has all kinds of artificial neon signs flashing at you if we just would notice them, right? This whole question about thinking that it just all happened naturally, no. Right?
But artificial, designed by beings that we can't even fathom in many ways.
Sure, right.
So it's like it's not...
But again, it's a being.
Right. It's not the negative artificial that we think of.
Yeah, again, artisans, right? Again, see, we've corrupted the word artificial.
Okay, I'm just...
See? It's a positive word. It's not a negative word. Right? Art is not a negative word. Art is a human word. See, and the more you reject the word artificial, the more you reject your humanity. Yeah, fancy animals don't do art. Right? Okay, yeah.
John Stevens was asking if the power beings, if you thought the power beings were responsible for the blanketing.
Again, you're noticing that it has that, you know, it acts like a blanket, and, you know, and has a parallel to why we make blankets out of wool, for instance, to shield us, to protect us, to provide a barrier. This is the open question. Right now in the ozone layer, if you study it more and more, will you come up where you're like, no, I can't quite pin down all of the specifics of the ozone layer on obvious chemical processes, you know, physical processes? Well, maybe I just haven't figured, you know, found everything yet. Maybe. Or maybe you've found there's a little piece of its behavior that's not due to, you know, just basic chemistry issues and stuff. And chemical transport and whatnot. Maybe power beings have a little something to do with it even right now. And maybe you could figure that out. Like I said, you could look for that. Doesn't have to be there. But it might be. Yep.
Could it be a being other than the power
beings? Right. And of course, there's a lot of times we kind of use power being as sort of a catch-all. I mean, there's a whole bunch of unrevealed beings that could be doing all kinds of things we don't know about. But beings that manipulate physical, you know, systems. Okay, so, all right, so now shift gears a little bit, kind of back to the sort of just paralleling a block in the Revelation. And this is kind of the meaty paragraph here, this great big paragraph. And they had some fun with this paragraph.
The lower 5 or 6 miles of the Earth's atmosphere is the troposphere. This is the region of winds and air currents which provide weather phenomena. Above this region is the inner ionosphere, and next above is the stratosphere. Ascending from the surface of the Earth, the temperature steadily falls for 6 or 8 miles, at which height it registers around 70 degrees below zero, Fahrenheit. This temperature range is from 65 to 70 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, is unchanged in the further ascent for 40 miles. This realm of constant temperature is the stratosphere. At a height of 45 or 50 miles, the temperature begins to rise, and this increase continues until, at the level of the auroral displays, a temperature of 1200 degrees Fahrenheit is attained. And it is this intense heat that ionizes the oxygen. But temperature in such a rarefied atmosphere is hardly comparable with heat reckoning at the surface of the Earth. Bear in mind that one half of all your atmosphere is to be found in the first 3 miles. The height of the Earth's atmosphere is indicated by the highest auroral streamers, about 400 miles.
Okay. There's a bunch of facts in there, and in general, like if you compare the specific, you know, like altitudes in the atmosphere and stuff that they're giving you there with the human source work, you know, they tweak things a little bit, like I said, just so that it's not unnecessarily introducing factual differences of, you know, of no consequence. Right, so they kind of synchronize it up with, you know, what we recognize today about the atmosphere. But, you know, remember also that, you know, there's nothing definitive about all these levels. The atmosphere is quite variable. And the transition between the troposphere and the stratosphere, you know, is not fixed, you know, with time or with latitude and, you know, our season or, you know, lots of things, okay? You know, so they're just giving you kind of ballpark basic things. But they tweak the ballpark things, so they're better ballpark sort of numbers to just toss out. Okay, so that's, so set the specifics of those facts aside. They've got some very interesting things here. Let's kind of start with the latter, maybe part first. So when they take you up to say 50 miles, and they point out that if you go above 50 miles, the temperature starts to increase, okay, dramatically. If you get up to the point where the temperature is up to like 1,200 Fahrenheit, as they're saying there, you've gotten up into the ionosphere. Okay, maybe the first thing I should say, that in terms of the atmosphere, you call that increasing temperature region way up there the thermosphere, okay, for obvious reasons. And what you have up there also is the ionosphere. You have atmosphere that's ionized to a degree, okay, so that you can have the aurora. And as you get up there, it gets a lot hotter than 1,200 as you continue up. You know, so again, what are they doing there? They're just saying, well, you kind of get up there into the real kind of solid base part of the auroral displays, and that's at about 1,200. Okay, see, so they're just giving you this sort of, but you can go a lot higher and go to in altitude and temperature. Right? They're not giving you the highest temperature or anything like that. Like I said, they're just kind of giving you some basic benchmark things. You know,
so this is still on the very edge of the atmosphere.
Okay, so this is, you're still in, you know, in the thermosphere. You're in the uppermost region of the atmosphere.
Okay,
it's very, very thin now, though.
But it's hot.
As they were stressing, right? So it's not like it would feel like 1,200 degrees, right?
Oh, okay.
I mean, you have so few molecules.
Oh, I see.
Okay? That's what they're trying to tell you there, right? It's very rarefied, okay? You know, the molecules are moving very fast. You know, that's the faster the molecules move, the higher the temperature, right? But there's, you know, relatively few, right? You know, all the molecules that are down here, if they're 1,200, that's a lot of, you know, things hitting you. But a couple things hitting you that fast is not going to feel hot.
Yeah, okay. You couldn't get burned.
Right. Okay. So that's what they're just trying to throw in that little bit. And again, that's, you know, that's in the human source work too. That's not revelation. They're not trying to teach us anything there. Again, they're giving you those basic facts, and they want you to reflect on what those facts in the human source work suggest to you, you know, or what's the bigger truth in play? Okay, so so they're getting you up kind of into the main part of the lower part of the auroral displays, you know, because that's going to transition you into the next thing they're going to bring up. Like I said, each one of these paragraphs sort of, you know, leads to the next one. They have this nice little sequence that takes you through the paragraphs. Okay, so, you know, see, and again, you know, they're trying to stress. I mean, and again, it doesn't hurt for someone maybe that's reading this book that they don't know anything about science, like I was stressing. They ought to have some factual sense of the atmosphere, you know, like that, you know, half of it is in the first 3 miles. Right? So when you're talking about being miles and miles up in the atmosphere, right, it's getting very, very, very thin. And you should appreciate that if you don't. Right, so you have a factual atmosphere that you see yourself living in rather than some magical atmosphere. Yeah?
What are the lowest altitudes that satellites travel around the Earth?
Okay, I mean, you know, you get up there in the low Earth orbit. You're up there in the thermosphere. See, and that's why those things in low Earth orbit... you know, there's a lot of drag, and you know, eventually they're going to come back down unless they're boosted up, right? You know, if you're up 400 miles up there, you know, you're it's very thin, but it's not like there's no atmosphere, right? You're up there in the thermosphere. Okay, so yeah, see again, and just you know, explore that some of yourself. You know, look up. It's like, well, what's the altitude of the International Space Station or something like that? You know, just go check and see how it fits in. Okay, but now the really biggie thing in here is, okay, we now, you know a lot more about the atmosphere than they did back in 1942. I mean, they were just beginning to explore, you know, try to, you know, send things up and get measurements, you know, up higher in the atmosphere. And, okay, so let me just tell you what we know now. We know now that you know, as you go up, the temperature gets colder. And you're going up in the troposphere, and you get to a coldest point called the tropopause. And then it warms up in the stratosphere until it reaches a maximum at the stratopause. And then it cools again in a region they don't talk about here called the mesosphere until you get to a cold point again called the mesopause. And then it starts warming up and gets hotter in the thermosphere that we were just talking about there. And going, wait a minute, that doesn't match what we have here. Here they said it got colder up to the tropopause and then stayed constant, you know, and then got hotter up in the thermosphere. And there was just a troposphere, a relatively constant temperature stratosphere, and then this increasing temperature thermosphere. I think I found an error in the book.
No. Another one?
Yeah. No. Okay, so back in the late 30s, early 40s, and there's first starting to get some stuff. It is the case that as you go above the tropopause, the coldest point, there the lower part of the stratosphere below the ozone layer is relatively constant temperature, right? And they had noticed that. You know, they got up a little bit above the troposphere and getting temperatures, and it's like, the temperatures are just same as you go up and up. But they hadn't gotten way up. You know, so back then when this article was written, they thought, okay, it must just stay constant up a ways, but we know that there's ionized, you know, there's an ionosphere, so we know it's, you know, getting hot up there, so there must be some point where it starts to get hotter. And they were just filling in the blanks, okay? You're going, well, why on earth would the revelators ignore that, you know, that increasing temperature actual stratosphere and then the cooling temperature mesosphere, you know, up getting up to the thermosphere? Why would they give this false statement? Again, the point is not the facts. What's the big thing that we were trying to get here? That it isn't a coincidence that there's an ozone layer. Okay, the only reason that you have it warming above the tropopause is because the ozone layer is absorbing energy and it's heating it up. Right, so it warms up the stratosphere. Okay, that's why it doesn't stay constant temperature. If you didn't have the ozone layer, it would stay constant temperature going up until you got up to where it was ionized. It would be like this. If you didn't have, you know, it would be just exactly like the revelators say here, as they've tweaked what's actually in the human source work to make it more precise like this. It would be just like they said, if there wasn't an ozone layer. I see, so they're saying, so think about how the human author didn't recognize that, but he's basically giving you, if we tweak it a little bit, he's giving you what the atmosphere would be like if there wasn't an ozone layer. Okay, but there is, quote unquote, coincidentally. No, it's not a fortuitous accident, right? Right? See, so they're giving you the background. What's natural is this. Yeah. That's not what you see. What I see is artificial. If the atmosphere was totally natural, it would be like they're describing here, but that's not what I see. See, they're doing the same thing. They're trying to get you to recognize just how many things are artificial about what you observe and take for granted.
Your pleasant life.
Ozone layers are there because the planet's been terraformed.
And is it higher than these? Is the ozone layer up out of?
No, no. Remember what they said back there. The densest part of the ozone layer is just exactly like they said, starting about 10 miles and going for another 10 miles up. Okay. Yeah, but that energy is absorbed and it heats up the stratosphere above that. Okay.
Oh, I see.
Okay. You've got to understand what the point of this is. The point is not to give you what you already have in that human source work from 1942.
So is this one of those cosmological facts that might be, that they tell you because of revelation, like you might find, discover something new in a short period of time?
They're just trying to get you to awaken to, you've already discovered many things, even back in the late 30s and early 40s, that aren't natural. Start to, think about that. How many other things are like that? Don't take things for granted, Think about it. And you'll begin to, recognize that your planet is lovingly cared for. It was brought lovingly into existence, and it's maintained lovingly in its existence. And you live within that grace. Right, it's not just grace. Isn't just about spirit. Grace is about everything. They're talking about physical grace. You shouldn't take grace for granted. Right, you should be thankful.
Don't piss grace off.
Okay, now okay. So that's the really kind of the biggie there. Is having a constant temperature stratosphere, which he's like, well, that's not correct. Okay, so I hope you get what they're doing there. The really fun. Oh, is there something on the webinar?
Well, Jeanette was asking if you might be able to tell us who the author, the human author of the source was.
I'm terrible at remembering names like that. His name is Dr. Harlan True Stetson, and it was in Scientific Monthly, June 1942. I think if I remember right, he was from MIT. Yes, he was from MIT. your Rancho Book readers that are interested in science, know about this, this human source work and stuff that's out there. I'm trying to just get you to recognize, what the really important things are here, that go beyond, just these immediately, dangling in front of you objects of these various facts, right? The facts are just there as a means for you to reflect on some bigger issues. But in terms of facts, there's a zinger they threw in there, okay? You read that human source work, and it doesn't say anything about an inner ionosphere. Matter of fact, no scientist says anything about an inner ionosphere. They talk about an ionosphere, which the revelators are calling the outer ionosphere. What the heck are they talking about here? They're saying you got the troposphere, and then you have a quote-unquote inner ionosphere, and then you have the stratosphere. What on earth are they talking about? So on the one hand, they seem to be talking about a stratosphere that isn't what we actually observe, and on the other hand, they're throwing in something that we don't seem to know anything about. Well, at least until late 80s, early 90s, 1990s, that we first began to get definitive scientific observations of, wait a minute, what the heck is going on here? There's something happening above the highest cloud tops. And some sort of a very low-intensity glowing phenomenon that's kind of aurora-like, but is projecting upward into the lower stratosphere. And there's also something very low intensity that's projecting down from what the relatives are calling the outer ionosphere. There's these subtle luminescent phenomena. The things that project down are called red sprites, and the things that project up are called blue jets. And see, the revelators are saying, they're just like laying it down. Don't dismiss that when you finally start to discover these things. There's a subtleness to the electric structure of the atmosphere that you haven't figured out yet. That's related to that subtleness of the magnetic field that we mentioned back in the previous paper. That doesn't have anything to do with the way you rationalize the magnetic field. Right? There's a whole electromagnetic nature of the planet that we don't understand. They're coupled together, right? And you really kind of have a three-plate system. You've got from that inner ionosphere between there and the ground, and you've got between that inner ionosphere and the outer ionosphere. So lightning and all that stuff is related to this, and
the
mysteries of understanding. Yeah, right, the mysteries of understanding the nature of lightning and stuff. Right, see, okay, so we can't get into the physics, right? But it's just tossing that out, okay, and encouraging you to pursue those mysteries. There's something much more profound there than you've figured out yet.
Yeah. The fact that they're introducing these in this section indicates that these were the prerequisites for life that they had to have in play.
Yeah.
Before life implantation.
Yeah. Remember how they talked about, that bit with the magnetic field, let's see, how did they word that? And all of this did much to facilitate the control of terrestrial energy and to regulate its flow as is disclosed by the functioning of the magnetic poles. Think about those words.
Yeah.
Control, regulate.
Yeah.
Right, this is all part of this complex system that has to be just so. Okay, magnetically, electrically, atomically, what have you. Okay? All right, so...
Let me read a couple of these because we don't have
them. just take one. There isn't huge things here. We're just going to step you through a few basic things. Again, where it's pretty much paralleling the human source work, but we want to try to figure out why they're bringing this up. Okay?
Auroral phenomena are directly related to sunspots, those solar cyclones which whirl in opposite directions above and below the solar equator, even as do the terrestrial tropical hurricanes. Such atmospheric disturbances whirl in opposite directions when occurring above or below the equator.
Okay, so basically, these four paragraphs are together for the truth. Okay, so but you see what they're doing, right? I mean, they're giving you enough from that human source work where you really have in front of you the sun on the one end, extending its influence across space, connecting with the Earth on the other end. They want you to see that, they're together as a system. They aren't two separate facts. They're coupled together, right? So synchronizing life with the terrestrial conditions means you're also synchronizing life with the sun, and the sun is part of a greater system. You're synchronizing, like I said, with the whole cosmos. Okay? All right?
The power of sunspots to alter light frequencies shows that these solar storm centers function as enormous magnets. Such magnetic fields are able to hurl charged particles from the sunspot craters out through space to the Earth's outer atmosphere, where their ionizing influence produces such spectacular auroral displays. Therefore, do you have the greatest auroral phenomena when sunspots are at their height, or soon thereafter, at which time the spots are more generally equatorially situated?
Yeah, and again, we basically, you know all that. We knew that back, you know, the human author knew that. You know, they're just repeating a lot of this. So the sunspots, their numbers, their areas of greatest numbers moves towards the equator as the sunspot cycle moves along, as they're referring to there. I mean, one of the basic things, you know, this is getting in this very controversial area in atmospheric science about just how much influence the sun has on the Earth. And the sun has cycles, and how much does that produce cycles on the Earth? This is argued a lot about, right? Okay, so you notice them, the fact that they're putting that forward is saying, you know, you really need to pursue that. There are things there, right? The Earth is very definitively coupled to the sun. And if the sun wiggles, the Earth wags, right? Okay.
If it burps, we're
in. Okay, so that's the that basic issue. And, you know, we don't need to get a lot into sunspots, but, you know, just, you see how they're bringing up this issue of their magnetic nature, and the parallels with, hurricanes or cyclones on the Earth. You know, so they're reinforcing those issues too. It all is just, trying to anchor future scientific exploration, in these facts. If you're going to rationalize things, make sure that you don't leave these issues out. Figure out, why we took statements out of a human source work and put them in a revelation like this, right? Held them up like that, gave them that sort of validation, And again, notice how the author at times will say, well, we think maybe or suggesting, and the revelators will definitively clear it up and, just say, no, it's not a maybe, it is that way. You can see how they're definitely trying to validate some of these thoughts or speculations like that. Okay, a little bit more.
Even the compass needle is responsive to this solar influence, since it turns slightly to the east as the sun rises, and slightly to the west as the sun near setting. This happens every day, but during the height of sunspot cycles, this variation of the compass is twice as great. These diurnal wanderings of the compass are in response to the increased ionization of the upper atmosphere, which is produced by the sunlight.
Right. So, we already mentioned you've got that ionization up there. So basically, again, notice how they're wanting to throw that little bit into from the human source work at stressing this coupling, right? And how, you noticed this a long time ago with your compasses, right? You've had compasses for a long time. You've been sailing ships and using them, and you've noticed this stuff, okay? And we're holding that up, okay, and get to the last little bit.
It is the presence of two different levels of electrified conducting regions in the superstratosphere that accounts for the long-distance transmission of your long and short-wave radio broadcasts. Your broadcasting is sometimes disturbed by the terrific storms which occasionally rage in the realms of these outer ionospheres.
Okay. Let me just deal with a little factual thing first, okay, and then let's look at the big truth of those four paragraphs. You can another place where you can get yourself wrapped around the axle. When they talk about the ionosphere, they talk about four layers: the D layer, the E layer, the F1, and the F2 layer. Okay. Notice that it's like, well, what are they talking about? It says there's just two. No, this doesn't say two layers. It says two levels. Oh, that's no difference. Yes, it is. because you have a whole spectrum of electron density, indicating how much it's ionized. It starts out very low, it increases and then decreases as you go way up. But there's some structure to that. It increases and reaches a little peak and then decreases a bit and then increases again to a peak and then decreases all the way up. There's two levels, that you've distributed four layers through. Okay? Amidst those four layers are two levels. Okay? So they're just focusing on those two. Different way of speaking about it, equally valid. Super stratosphere above the stratosphere.
So how does it account for the long distance transmission?
Because you send radio waves at a certain frequency and they're reflected off. And the shorter ones are reflected off higher than the longer ones.
Which makes it so you
can listen to a radio station that's a long ways away because it's gone up, bounced off the ionosphere and come back down to you.
Because it's got a shorter versus a longer?
Well, again, it just, the longer ones bounce up at lower altitudes, and the shorter ones, they bounce off at a higher altitude. And all that stuff, is known, okay?
Not by me.
Right. Right.
I'm humble.
Right. But, we all know that, you can listen to an AM radio station that's a long ways away, right? Because it's bouncing off the ionosphere.
The rest of the story.
Okay. All right, so...
like having a dish up in the atmosphere.
And so, if you look in the human source, we go, okay, well, this is pretty close to just exactly what's in there. They've tweaked it a little bit and whatnot. But, okay, why? Why are they devoting four paragraphs in the Revelation? Again, they're just trying to leverage off that human source work some more to get you to think about... See, even, think about how useful radio is. Have you, noticed how dependent you are on the sun? And it's, if the sun burps, your whole system is messed up. Like they're pointing out at the end there. Right. So they're trying to get you to think about experiences that you have in your relationship to the sun and what they're dealing with in designing life and getting it to all work. Right? They have to take into account the variabilities and, the fickleness of the sun, if you will, and all this. Right, and again, just you can appreciate how you live in this bigger system, and they're designing in that bigger system. It's all that everything they've drawn from the human source work has that basic reason behind it, right? To get you to reflect on the vastness and the complexity of the system, and how much they have to consider to design life that is going to be resilient. They have to plan for lots of different, contingencies. Okay? The fact that they're very good at that is demonstrated by the fact that I'm sitting here today. 550 million years ago, they put single-celled plants, in these shallow seas. And they made it through all the vicissitudes to me. Okay, they know their stuff, again, like we were saying earlier, you can trust the control that's going on. Right? It has integrity. It's far seeing and very wise. Okay, and. It should help you with doing what Jesus told you to do. Fear not. Okay? We have a lot of fear in humanity associated with the atmosphere right now. There's no way you can do step one of what Jesus told you to do for the fourth epical revelation if that's your religion. The fear-based religion of the atmosphere. Okay? Many people are... their lives are dominated by this fear-based religion now. Okay, there's many lessons here of objectivity, of truth, of beginning an actual human life that transcends fear. Animals are afraid, not humans. You know the revelators say animal fear. They say that.
And No, I know. What's stronger than atmosphere?
Right. Hope. Yeah. Right. What can antidote fear? Right. Faith. And what can faith be grown into? Trust. Okay. Okay, so that's the, you know, like they said, terrestrial and spatial. That's the terrestrial part. Fun little vamping on a human source work. And then next time we'll get into some discussions about sub-electronic environment. All right, so let's take a little moment here.